Hello, I'm your host, Bill Vlad, president and founder of the executive search firm Vlad & Company. Thank you for downloading this episode of The Clip, a podcast dedicated to sharing ideas behind and examples of good leadership via candid interviews with inspiring Canadians.
In 2007, things couldn't have been going much better for Lisa Lisson. She had married her high school sweetheart, applied her marketing degree to a position at FedEx Express Canada, and climbed to the top by becoming vice president and later president of the company. One night, after putting their children to bed, her husband Patrick marveled that their lives seemed perfect. Just a few hours later, everything changed. That's read from the inside cover of Lisa Lisson's book, Resilience, Navigating Life, Loss, and the Road to Success. And inside those pages, she goes into much personal detail about the loss of her husband, the vegetative state that he was in for 2 years, and how she battled through it and what she learned both professionally and personally and what she was going to apply going forward. It's a very good book where every chapter incorporates not only a personal exercise, but a professional exercise that we can all learn from. And I'm going to read from the inside cover on the back of the book. Lisa Lisson is the president of FedEx Express Canada. She assumed the job at the age of 41, becoming both the company's first female and first Canadian president. FedEx Express Canada has been on the best employer list every year under her leadership. She was awarded a Diamond Jubilee Medal in recognition of her achievements and was inducted into the Women's Executive Network Top 100 Most Powerful Women Hall of Fame in 2015. She's on the board of directors for Sick Kids Foundation and the Business Council of Canada. She currently lives in Burlington with her children, and she's our guest today on The Clip. Hope you enjoy. To the roads ahead. So let me ask you, out of the gate, why the need to tell such a personal story?
I did this for three reasons. I did it for my children, first and foremost, because my kids were 9, 7, 5, and 3 when this happened. Yeah. So I did it for them because they have a million questions now. Like, they're like, did we kiss daddy the night he passed away? And they did, but I couldn't tell them that he was about to die in the next 3 hours, right? And then, so I did it for them. And then what I didn't realize was very therapeutic for me, because during those 2 years when he was in his vegetative state, I was just like robot, right? And now going back from a position of strength, I could like process things better. And the third thing is to help people.
Is it fair to say, we're talking about a book called Resilience, and the book does talk about your progress professionally and personally. And it's always interesting when I talk to guests about where they started from. Would it be fair to say that you started off with a financially stressful youth? And if so, how did that shape you? How did that create you as a professional, do you think?
Well, actually, how I started out in terms of what age, like when I was...
Yeah, when you were young, with your parents.
Yeah,
and
yeah. Well, so basically, my parents divorced when I was 5. And my brother was 3. And I admire them for that, because they realized that they were not meant to be together. And so they separated. And at first that was tough because, you know, I was old enough to understand what was happening. I admire my parents for a couple of things. Number one, they both realized they weren't meant to be together. Number two, how they handled the situation. Number three, they made it amazing for me. They were like, okay, you're going to get 2 Christmases and 2 birthdays and 2 vacations. So I don't really have any memory of my parents being together, very, very little. So that's how I started my childhood. And then they both married people that had, you know, other siblings. And so I went from having 1 brother to having 6. And so that's kind of, that was my upbringing. And so it was interesting in the sense that, it was a very kind of this kind of, I always say it was like the Brady Bunch, but my parents handled it so well, and I admire them for that.
You can't reverse engineer history, and I won't give all the details to the traumatic scenarios that you've gone through. We know, you know, the book speaks right at the opening about the passing of your husband, but there are many other points of trauma within your life. Do you think you would have been as successful in your personal career had you not had to battle through those traumatic scenarios?
Yeah, you know, it's a very interesting question. And I often reflect on that, because by the time I was like 40, I had done 3 eulogies. My father, when I was in my last year of university, he was 47 and I was 21. He gets diagnosed with brain cancer. And his goal was to make it to my graduation, and he died just a few weeks before that. And at the time when I was 21, I thought, oh, well, 47, you know, he's lived a long life. Right now I'm 48, and I realize now how young that truly was. So I had that. Then my best friend's sister was murdered, and she was like my little sister, because as I mentioned earlier on, I've got six brothers. I always wanted a sister. She gets murdered, and then the family asked me to do the eulogy, which I was just so moved by, and I wanted to make sure I did a good job. So I did my dad, and then I did my best friend's sister. And then I'm thinking, okay, like, my goodness, two lives lost so young. And then I did my third with my husband. So I obviously did a lot of soul searching. I realized how quickly life can change in a second. I realized that you have to live with a purpose, and you have to make sure that you are enjoying every single moment that you have, because I've seen it go so quickly three times with the three eulogies that I have done in my life. And so did that help me get to this job? It's an interesting question, because if that didn't happen, would I still be here? The answer is probably, I probably still would be here, because I've always been a very driven person. My mom has always raised me to believe that I can accomplish what I set. I can accomplish my goals. I'm a very goal-oriented person. They say that those people that write down their goals are more successful than those that don't. And those people that not only write them down, but wake up and figure out what baby step they can do to take them are more successful. So I think I probably would have been here if that had not happened, but I would be a different person, maybe. Different type of leader. I might not be, I might not live with as much gratitude as I have in my life. I wake up every morning and I focus on what I have in my life, not what's missing. I might not be as empathetic. Mm-hmm. But it's hard to tell, right? It's hard to tell.
You know, some of the other podcasts that I've done, because the people I was speaking with say one of the challenges or the concerns they have about the next generation is that there hasn't been a lot of turmoil or stress or chaos, because they've been protected and they've been coddled, and that, you know, having a crappy job as your first job is a great example of even that being enough to give people some sort of sense of pride and duty. Mm-hmm. And we're taking away a lot of this stuff from the younger generation. Mm-hmm. And they're concerned about whether or not they'll be able to be good leaders if they don't have that trauma and stress and drama to be able to recognize, as you said on page 35, it's what you choose to do in response to what happens. Mm-hmm. And mm-hmm. if you haven't had anything happen, mm-hmm. how do you know how to respond?
Yeah, it's very interesting, because I think that when something happens in your life that is unexpected, whether it be you didn't get your first job, whether it be something traumatic as losing someone in your life, it really teaches you a lot of life lessons. It teaches you that life does not always go according to plan. It teaches you that you can be the most optimistic person on the planet. I'm still an optimistic person, but optimism cannot always bring what you want in life. So it does teach you resilience. And so, you know, we'll see. I mean, for my children who have gone through such trauma, I'm so proud of them, because they have learned resilience at a very young age.
Yeah. And it's a tool that you don't know how powerful it is until, you actually have to put it into practice. Tips on returning to work after an absence. We have a program, it's called the Executive Career Academy, where people come back to work, or they've been let go of jobs from their job, and they're trying to come back into the workforce. And I'm always interested in what people who have left work for a traumatic reason, how do you come back to work? How do you face the onslaught of your colleagues who may or may not know what you're going through and still be a productive individual in the workplace? Any tips?
Yeah. So for me, when I came back to work, I had such anxiety because I was just worried about, I didn't want people to feel sorry for me. I didn't want people to look at me and treat me any differently. What I really wanted was to people just to treat me like I was before what happened to me in my life. And so when I came back into the workforce, when I walked in these doors the very first day, I remember coming up the stairs and going to my office. And I thought, I'm in control of this in the sense that they're going to look to me first to see what is my attitude, my body language, my mood. I always say this, your attitude introduces yourself before you even speak. So I was like, you know what? I'm going to walk in there just like nothing has happened. I went, hey, good morning. How are you? Are we good? Ready for the meeting? And everyone around me is like, oh, okay. And no one said a word about what happened. I took control of the situation and we just went in like, let's go. But if I came in with my head down and woe is me, then they would have been like, are you okay? But I walked in there like, I've got this. I always say this, the most important conversation we have in life is with ourselves. So if I walked in there going, everyone's going to feel sorry for me. I went in there saying, I've got this. I'm in control. Let's go. And I walked in there like, hey, good morning. Let's get a coffee. Everyone ready? What do you need? Okay. Who's on first? Let's go. Done. They picked up my lead. So that's the best advice I would have for people.
Another tool that you used, and I was concerned when I first started reading it because I thought, geez, I don't know how this is going to work, is compartmentalization. You put things into little baskets to deal with at different times. Tell me how that worked and what value did it give to you?
So basically what I meant by that is that when I came back to work, I knew when I walked in these doors, I had to park the fact that my husband at the time was in a vegetative state. I had four young babies, and when I walked in these doors, I had to be present in the moment of now. So I was going to park and compartmentalize the other life forces that I had outside of work that were coming at me. And what I learned is this. Our mind, for whatever reason, does two things. It either lives in the past and goes back, and I was always living in the past, remembering when my husband was healthy or I should have done this or what could I have done differently, like always living in the past. Or if I wasn't living in the past, then my mind was always worrying about the future. Who's going to walk my girls down the aisle when they get married? Who's going to take my son to hockey? And it was just such wasted energy because it was robbing me of the moment that I was in. So when I say like I compartmentalize, what I mean is I certainly have to think about the future. I plan about the future, but I don't let my mind worry about the future or live in the past. I try and make sure that in the moment I'm in, I'm present. So if I'm at work, I am present with my team. When I'm with my kids or my family, I am present with them. And you have to park the other noises that you have in your head and deal with them when the time is right.
I want to take a little bit of a change in direction here. And with respect to FedEx, the PSP model, for the people listening to the podcast, people, service, profit. Quick description of what that means. And the question I want to ask you is it breakable? Is that model breakable? Is there a way, or is that just ironclad? You follow the PSP model and there's success.
Our founder, Fred Smith, when he created this company, this wonderful company I've been with for 26 years, it's people, service, profit. And what that means is you treat your people with trust, respect, you empower them. And when you do that, they will deliver the service to your customers, the impeccable service, and what we actually call the purple promise. And the purple promise is this: I will make every FedEx experience outstanding. So when we ask our employees, can you deliver on the purple promise? What we're asking them is to make sure that every FedEx experience is outstanding. And when they do that, that will deliver the profit that we need to not only return to our shareholders, but reinvest back in people and then back in service to our customers. It is our culture, it is our DNA, and it is unbreakable. You've heard this before, this line, which is, your culture will eat your strategy for breakfast. So you can have the best strategy in the world, But if you don't nurture your culture, enhance it, reinforce it, take care of it, you're going to fail out of the gate. And so one of the things that has kept me with FedEx, as long as I have been with FedEx, is this wonderful, amazing culture. And you will find that the majority of people that are at FedEx are here for their career. Like me. I started out
entry level. Like Laura.
Yeah.
Joe,
exactly. I started out entry level and here I am now.
Mentorship was a big part of your career.
Absolutely.
How did you find these people? What was the process that you personally did to say, I need to go after that person?
So basically, here's the thing about going to ask someone to be your mentor. It's a really daunting process. So the first thing I did is that I wanted to find some mentors that were in my field, which was marketing. And I also wanted to find some mentors that were outside of my field. I'm an extrovert person. That's just my personality. But I wanted to also find mentors that were the opposite of my personality. So I made sure that I had some that were like me that could help me guide me and nurture my current personality, my current style of an individual. But I also found mentors that were the opposite of me to help me work on the areas that I needed to grow upon. And then what I did is this. I went up to them and said, would you be my mentor for just 1 year? I just will ask for 30 minutes of your time. It can be a phone call or in person. And I will send you the questions in advance. Would you be my mentor? Because I would really like to learn from your playbook. I'd love to know how you got to be a manager or a managing director or a VP. And could you, because I'm very interested in doing that as well. I'd like to follow your career. Could you help me? And I just for 12 months, 30 minutes, once a month, questions in advance. They would say no problem. Now, for those that said, I'm mentoring so many people right now. I just cannot take you on. I would say this, okay, could I just have 30 minutes of your time and I just will ask you 5 questions. I'm going to send them to you in advance, just 5 questions. Can I have 30 minutes and that's it? No problem. So I could pick their brain and I would ask them the questions about what were the key things that you did to get where you are today? What are the things that you wish you had done differently? What advice would you have for up-and-comers like me in the company trying to get to where you are? I would say to them, do you recommend any other leadership courses or anything else that I could take within the company? Because right now there's so many online courses in companies now. I mean, you know, young people coming into companies today have got more resources and more tools than ever. So I would ask them these questions. And I will honestly say this, without my mentors, and I still have them today, I would not be in this job.
Now, on the flip side to that, you're still coaching. You, in your book, you're talking about coaching individuals. Do you not have enough to do? Like, why are you still feeling the need to coach other people?
Well, I coach and mentor a lot of people for 2 reasons. Number one, I really enjoy helping others. I really do. And that's part of the reason why I wrote this book, is to help others. I love sharing what I've learned to help them because it's paying it forward. Because the people that helped me get to where I am did it for me. And I want to do that to help others, number one. Number two, what also is really, which I realized early on when I started mentoring, is that when I'm giving them career advice or talking to them, it's also a reminder to me to go, oh, right, I got to make sure that I'm doing some of these things. Mm. So it's equally beneficial. I'm giving them career advice and reminding them to do, you know, A, B, and C. And I'm like, oh, wait a minute. Have I done that last week? Right. So it's mutually beneficial.
One of the things that you talk about in the book, which if you could expand a little bit in terms of how you use it, is visualization. I have 2 of my older boys are ski racers, and visualization is a big thing because you have to actually walk – in your mind, ski the course.
Before you do it.
Mm-hmm. How did you use that in work?
So basically, I truly believe in visualization in the sense that if you want to picture yourself in a different spot where you are now, whether it's your son's going down the hill, whether it was me being a manager when I, and I now am working towards being a managing director, I would start to visualize myself in that role. What's really important though is this. When you want to be at that next level of your career, you need to act and think like you're there, but in a humble way. So I would visualize myself, I'm a managing director now. I see myself there. So I started thinking about, if I were my boss, what questions would I ask of me? How would I conduct this meeting? And so I would visualize myself there. I would think that I was there, but in a humble way. And that would always help me to get towards my next goal.
Do you still do it? Do you still use that technique?
I still do. So for example, you know, if I'm going to do, into a customer meeting and it's a big negotiation, I'm visualizing myself in terms of the key points that I need to say in that meeting for the negotiation to go well. Or if I'm out to do a big speech in front of a lot of people, I visualize myself there, visualizing myself being successful in it. And I always say, I've got this. I said earlier on, right? Your most important conversation we have in life is with ourselves. What if I say, this is not going to go well, I'm not going to get the interview, I'm not going to get the job, then you're basically setting yourself up for failure. So visualization is huge. But also you have to attach that to what you're thinking and what you're telling yourself about getting to where you want to go. So for your sons, as an example, they're visualizing themselves going down the ski hill. But if at the top of the hill saying, oh my goodness, I don't think I can do this, the visualization is useless.
Mm-hmm.
So they're connected.
Another tool, and I don't want to give away all the great tools you have in the book, because people should read it because there's a lot of material in it. But one that I picked out was writing down your goals.
Mm.
Do you still do that?
Indeed. So it is a proven fact that those people that write down their goals, whether it's on a piece of paper or in, you know, your current phone or whatever the case may be, those people that write down their goals are more successful than those that are not. But it's not just about writing down your goals. You have to write them down. Then you have to figure out, what baby step could I do to get there? So what could I do tomorrow on that goal that I didn't do today? So I have personal and I have professional goals. Some are short term, some are longer term. So not all goals need to be like 5 years out. Some should be short, some should be long. You write them down and then you need to take time. You need to carve out time to pause and reflect. I call it white space on the calendar, actually, where you just carve out time where you're just being in the moment, no distractions, and you're looking at your goals and you're saying, okay, and if it's a Friday or a Sunday, whatever the case may be, what could I do next week to advance myself towards that goal that I'm not doing now? And it just needs to be something. And then when you figure out what that something is, then all of a sudden, it just starts to fall into place. That's happened to me my entire life. I still do it today, and I still figure out what baby steps I can take towards what I want to achieve.
Any examples? What's on that list now that maybe you can walk us through? Like, here's what I want to achieve, and what is your process going to be to kind of get to that?
So, you know, for me right now, actually, I'll give you a better example. Okay, let me tell you this example. So for 2 years, I had so many people after my husband passed away saying, you should tell your story, you should write a book. And I would say, why would anyone want to hear what I had to say? I honestly did not believe that I really had a story. So after 2 years of just kind of like, I thought maybe I should give this a shot because everyone kept coming to me. So then I wrote on my list, I'm going to write a book. And that was on my list for my goal list for, I don't know, 6 months, I don't even know how long. And there was one Sunday when I was sitting in my home office, I'm like, okay, what could I do to help me write this book? And I knew I needed a ghostwriter, and I have a wonderful ghostwriter. Her name's Wendy Dennis. But at the time, I didn't know her. So like, what could I do? So I was doing a lot of speeches for FedEx, and I had this great speechwriter that did a lot of my speeches. And I emailed him on this Sunday and said, by any chance, do you, you know, write books in addition to speeches? He's like, I've been waiting for you to ask me this. He said, actually, I don't, but have I got the person for you? And then he put me in touch with Wendy Dennis. So then I met with Wendy and I said, Wendy, I'm interested in writing a book. Everyone's telling me I should. Do you want to meet for coffee? She said, I'd love to. So I met with Wendy and we sat there and I said, this is kind of my life. And Wendy was the defining moment because I said to her, I'm going to tell you my life. And if you say there's a story, great. If you say there's not, then I can say, check the box. I tried and it comes off my goal list. Told her my story and she said, when can we start? If I had not sat in that office on that Sunday thinking about how could I bring this to this goal to life, I wouldn't even be sitting here with you right now.
In the book, you also, with all of the crap that you had to endure, and then you go to your colleagues and you turn the lens on yourself and you're asking to get people to tell you what your personal flaws are. First of all, was that challenging to hear people tell you about your weaknesses? And the second thing to that question is, any tips on how people can get to that point where they can recognize, I need to know more about my flaws and how to do that in an effective manner?
So I truly believe that there's no such thing as the perfect person, whether you're a leader, whether you're anything. There's no such thing as a perfect person. And we always need to be in a state of continuous improvement because the world around us is not static. It's always changing. So we always need to be learning and growing. And so I will admit for sure early on in my career when I would ask people, you know, tell me areas that I need to improve on, when you're an up-and-comer and you're just like, I've got this, it's hard to hear that. But I realized that we have to seek out the areas where we need to improve. And in doing that, that will help us to grow and help us to achieve our goals. So I'll give you a perfect example. I am not a patient person. I'm not. And earlier on in my career, I'm a type A driver. I would be like, go, go, go. Let's get it done. Cross the list. And, you know, one of my mentors actually said to me, you need to slow down because you're losing people along the way. Your mind is moving so quickly that you're already from like A to D and people are like, where's B? So you got to slow down and you cannot expect people to work at the fast pace that you do. And that was a big like aha moment for me. And I'll tell you to this day, so my biggest Achilles heel is patience. I don't have a lot. I have to work on it. But him telling me that earlier on in my career, I truly believe this. If he did not tell me that, I honestly don't know if I would be sitting here talking to you right now.
Right. Yeah. It's a helpful exercise, but one that people sometimes fear and therefore don't execute on.
And you know what? And the problem is that by not executing on it, it will actually hurt them because mm-hmm. they're not gaining information that could help them achieve those goals that we talked about earlier on in writing them down.
Mm-hmm. Another part of your book, which is it troubles me because I wish I had a better solution for it, is you empathize with women who feel they can't advance their careers like they would like, but you don't share their frustration.
You know, I do mentor a lot of women, and a lot of women feel that what they share with me is that, you know, I'm not going to go for that promotion because I want to have a baby. And I'm like, well, why is that going to stop you? Like, you should go for it. Like, that should not matter. And one of my mentors told me that. And you know, and I talk about it in the book, like I was trying to decide, should I have a baby now or not? She's like, well, why? What are you waiting for? So what I coach women on is a couple things. Number one, don't let your thoughts about a family slow your career down. Because I did not let that stop me. I have four kids. And in fact, when I became a vice president, I was pregnant with my fourth child. So don't let your family plans slow you down, and don't believe that you have to put your career in a back seat. If you want to have a great career and a family, you can find a way to make them work. And I truly believe that. I think the second thing too is that there's this thing called this confidence gap that, you know, you can read about it. But what it says is this. It says that men will go for that next promotion when they feel they're like 60% ready. But it says in these studies that women wait until they're 100% ready. And there's no need for that. There is no need. Maybe, I don't know, women maybe tend to be a bit more perfectionist than men. I don't know. But that's a proven fact. So what I tell women is that if you feel like, you know what, I think I'm almost there. You know what, why not? Let's do it. Then do it. And so that's the thing. And I learned that early on in my career. So, you know, you cannot let go back to that inner voice. You cannot let that inner voice say to you, well, I'm not perfectly ready for that next promotion, or, you know, I want to have a baby, so I don't think I should try and advance my career. Why not? Why not?
Final couple of questions here. Biggest career mistake you've made?
The biggest career mistake I made was when I took over the job of vice president of marketing and sales, I made decisions too quickly. And as a leader, when you're coming into a new role, they always say this, we've got two ears and one mouth for a reason, right? And when you're coming into a new role, you need to listen more than you speak. I was listening, but I then made decisions too quickly early in my career and in that particular job, and I should have not rushed. And it goes back to what I said earlier on. What is my number one issue? Lack of patience. So that was my biggest mistake, is that I made decisions too quickly. And from that, though, the life lesson there is that I make sure now that when I make decisions, I'm more consultative, I'm involving the team, and I make sure I pause and reflect.
Let me ask you some personal questions to wrap it up then. What does a 5-hour plane ride mean to you? What do you get accomplished? What do you, when you think, okay, I'm traveling from here to, I don't even know where 5 hours is away.
Vancouver,
okay. Yeah. What does that mean to you? What do you got in your head?
You know, so for me, a 5-hour plane ride, I actually enjoy getting on planes because, you know, being a single mom to 4 kids, I truly believe that we need to carve out white space on the calendar. I'm a firm believer in that. So I try and carve out white space both at work. So I'll carve out at least 3 to 5 hours a week where my door is shut, I'm on the phone, and I'm looking at the goals I need to accomplish that week or that month. And I also carve out 5 hours at least a week, if not more, just for me personally, whether I'm meeting a friend for a coffee. So I do believe in that. It's very important for us to be our own individual self, not a mom, not a leader, we need that. And those people that carve out white space for them are more successful in life than those are not. So when I get on a plane ride, I automatically get 5 hours of white space on my calendar.
Unless you get a chatty neighbor.
Yeah, well, I put those headphones on. But so I will use that time for a couple things. You know, if I am, you know, if it's something like if I've been running like crazy the past week and I'm behind an email, I will get caught up on my email. So when I land, I can start fresh. If my email is good, I will then try and maybe watch a movie, because I don't get hardly any time to actually watch a movie. So I love those 5 hours because they're my 5 hours to do whatever I absolutely want to do.
Are there any questions that you think that I should be asking or anything else you wanted to address?
It was interesting with this book because, like I said, it took me 2 years to wrap my head around whether I had after people tell me you should tell your story. I was honestly like, why would anyone want to hear what I have to say? Like, I really didn't think I had anything to share. And then once I did, and then it's like, okay, well, then I was like, well, what do people ask me? They ask me, how did you go from entry level to first Canadian, first female in 18 years? They asked me, like, you know, how did you deal with him being in a vegetative state for 2 years and raising the kids? And then a year to the day, almost he passed away, you get this, the president's job. And how do you do it today? And how did you get through all of that, not being bitter at life, but actually come through it stronger than what you started, right? And so that's why I was like, okay, then I, so if I'm going to do this, I'm not just going to write a book on grieving, because when you, as you know, when you lose somebody, as tragic as that is, it cannot define you and you cannot let it destroy your life. Like you could be a very bitter person. You could have be like, I'm so mad at life. And some people that lose people take that path and they never recover.
Right.
And I think when life throws us curveballs as traumatic as losing people suddenly in our lives, we have a choice. One choice is to let it define us, let us make bitter and just, so then you go from not, you don't, you just go from, you just exist through life. You don't live it. Or you take what happened and you find the life lessons, the aha moments like you did about your career. And you say, you know what? I've got one shot at this life. I'm going to make the best of it. And I'm going to make sure that I have no regrets. And if something is not making me happy in my life, I'm going to change it. And but a lot of people don't do that, right? And that's the thing about resilience. So resilience is basically, you know, when life punches you in the gut, you find resilience by coming through that punch stronger than what you started. And for those that don't, then unfortunately, they never find resilience.
Well, thank you for writing the book. Thank you for telling the story. And thank you for the time that you spent with us on this podcast.
My pleasure.
Well, I hope you liked this episode of The Clip.
Special thanks for this episode go out to Anna Burnell, Natasha Pereira, and our fine editors at Soul Food Productions.
Be sure to leave comments in the comments section and rate us if you can. It really does help us understand what you, the listener, wants to hear. And if you haven't already, please subscribe so that you receive the newest episodes of The Clip as they come hot off the podcast presses. To the roads ahead.